This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. My name is Bree Lee. I am the author of Eggshell Skull and what we're here to talk about tonight, Beauty. It is my pleasure to welcome you to the Wheeler Centre. Of course, we start by acknowledging that we are meeting today on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri and Boon Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and to any First Nations people who are here with us today. I would like to add to that acknowledgement that I was born in and raised in Brisbane, which is Yagara and Turrbal land. And something I try to do at events is to bring an acknowledgement back into the room with something I've learned recently, which is that it was only last week that I believe the University of Newcastle, in working with Guardian Australia, found yet another series of state-sanctioned massacres of Indigenous Australians. And the lead researcher in that project made the timely comment that police and the state have always been present at the sites of black deaths in this country. So when I say that I acknowledge that this is Aboriginal land, I add to that that history will judge Malcolm Turnbull for his deliberate mischaracterisation of a voice to Parliament being a third chamber. With respect. So thank you so much for joining us. I would like to introduce our incredible panellists. First, I'll go from my immediate left. Dr. Nikki Stamp holds a Bachelor of Medicine and Bachelor of Surgery with honours from the University of Western Australia and is a Fellow of the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons, specialising in cardiothoracic surgery. Nikki works as a cardiac surgeon and has a strong desire to change the way we think about health. She is the author of two books, Can You Die of a Broken Heart? And her most recent, Pretty Unhealthy. Please give her a warm welcome. Following on from Nikki, we have Abby Mag, who is a proud Dinka Boer woman of Junub, Sudan, now formerly known as South Sudan. A current public relations student, curator, and social influencer, Abby's interests lay in the use of social media and how it can be utilised as a means of telling stories and changing narratives. She's been published and featured in various magazines, including Archer Magazine, Teen Vogue, and Bustle. Please give her a very warm welcome. And finally, on the far left, Frances Cannon, who is a queer multidisciplinary artist based here in Nam. She works predominantly in drawing and painting in ink, gouache, and watercolour. Frances's work examines ideas of body love and body loathing, anxiety, relationships, sex and sexuality, gender and bodily functions. She's been involved in 10 successful solo shows and numerous group shows. She's worked with places like Teen Vogue, Gucci, Refinery 29, and she's the co-owner and director of Pink Ember Studio in Coburg. Please give her a very warm welcome. For anyone unfamiliar with beauty, it's kind of, I hoped it would be a combination of philosophy, memoir, literary and social criticism, basically questioning why, first of all, we still can't get rid of this idea of thinness being the best, but also, as well as that, an examination of perfectionism, of self-loathing. And it really, I think it's cause for concern that when we revisit a text like The Beauty Myth by Naomi Wolf, which celebrates its 30-year anniversary next year, not only have we not solved some of those problems, despite how incredibly far feminism has come, some of them are getting worse. And so that's what I hope beauty as an essay does. To kick off the conversation tonight, I want to start with you, Nikki, because I would love to almost preemptively clear the air and hear about how what you've done with Pretty Unhealthy, your latest book, debunking the oversimplification that thinness equals health. Because so often when we have these conversations, people get to talk about fatness as though they are concerned for fat people's health and well-being. And it's just such a great opportunity to have you here to debunk that straight up top.
Yeah, so I think you've really hit the nail on the head. We have this erroneous thinking that beauty and its surrogate, which in Western society is often thinness and whiteness, is a marker of your health and well-being, and that, as you sort of alluded to, if you don't fit that mould, we feel that it is our right and our duty to remark on someone's body, but we rationalise it to them and to ourselves by saying it has something to do with their health and we're doing them a favour. What we're doing is actually shaming people. And when we're looking in physical or mental health, any kind of shame, it just does not work. It does not make people feel better. It does not make them change behaviours. It backfires completely. And the other side to that is that, you know, a lot of the messaging around our health behaviours, there's a few things. First of all, it fails to take into account the social determinants of health. So if you want to talk about someone's physical well-being, you want to tell them that they should, you know, eat less or exercise more, whatever that is. But the thing is that we fail to take into account that all of these choices that we're supposed to make don't happen in a vacuum. And particularly if you're socially disadvantaged in any way, those choices are very, very difficult to make. And the other point to make is really that, you know, you can't make a judgment on someone's health and well-being just by looking at them. And that is something that the beauty industry and particularly more recently, I think, health and wellness industry have tried to get us to believe that you need to look a certain way to be physically and mentally healthy. And the science just doesn't stack up there. It's not true. Those things exist to make us feel bad about ourselves. They exist in an evidence-free zone that they're not necessarily going to make us feel any better. They're trying to make us look better. They're trying to make us feel bad about ourselves so that we'll want to look better. And it's all just, it's really a lie.
Mm. Abby and Frances, I saw you nodding a lot. Did you want to add anything to that?
Not yet.
That's totally fine.
I think you summed it up.
Yeah, no.
No, that's cool. Frances, how much of the beauty bullshit in this essay is actually specifically hetero beauty bullshit?
I think hetero and like beauty stuff like crossover quite a lot, so I'm very nervous. But I think within the queer community, there's also a lot of pressure to look a certain way as well. And I think thinness is also a really big like pressure within the queer community. And it's something that mainstream media doesn't often show fat queer people, especially fat queer women, fat lesbians in particular. So that's definitely something that, like, there's a lot of, like, crossovers there too. Yeah.
Thank you. Abby, do you feel respected every time you model?
I think so, yeah. I am a freelance model, so I get to choose who I get to work with.
Mm.
And I've had the privilege of having people who really want to work with me and really take on what I bring in and want to show that in terms of the job that I'm doing. So, yeah, I believe so.
Mm. Some of the questions that the essay raises are about models potentially being both, obviously, victims of the thin ideal, but also perpetrators. Mm. What did you think about as you were reading those sections?
When I was reading the book, I really couldn't, in terms of my personal idea of thinness and where I fit into it in the category, I couldn't really, I don't want to say that I couldn't relate to it, but I, my thoughts are like jumbled up right now. Yeah, we might have to come back to me
for
that.
Totally fine. Nikki, did you want to add something, I know, to that question of complicity?
Yeah,
I think that we're all complicit sometimes, mm-hmm. Particularly those of us who, just by nature of who we are, how we were born, our mm-hmm. heritage, are closer to the thin white ideal, mm-hmm. you know, and that's true for some of us. You know, we will always be closer than someone else. So I think that we are all potentially playing a role in perpetuating these ideas. I think that the question around, you know, the models, for example, you're absolutely right. These people are, you know, by virtue of their occupation, they have to fit that ideal. And, you know, I do feel sympathy and empathy for them, because that must be a really, you know, it's a damaging thing sometimes for some of them. But at the same time, they also benefit from that system. Mm. They benefit from that ideal. And we were just talking earlier about, you know, not quite in the model sphere, but wellness influencers or celebrities who have had histories of eating disorders or disordered eating, or who, again, just by virtue of their genetics, where they were born, when they were born, etc., that they are also perpetrating the thin ideal, and then they are the same people who sometimes go on to sell wellness products mm. like diet books and cookbooks and all these kinds of things. And it's a very, I think it's an uncomfortable dichotomy mm. because you're right, they are both victim and perpetrator. Mm. And while you want to feel sad and sorry for them and, you know, say it's okay, you also want to say how could you knowingly perpetuate the struggle which you have labored under.
Mm. Closely connected to the question of models is obviously the question of magazines. Something I would love to hear from both Abby and Frances is how Vogue can be so crap and yet Teen Vogue can be so good.
It's probably just about who they've hired in the room where everything gets, like, started, like, in the boardroom or whatever. I'm sure that they have just from the stuff that they put out, they must have a much more varied, like, staff. But, yeah, like, they Teen Vogue does so much better with intersectionality and talking about issues that really matter and talking about politics as well. Like, you mm. don't see Vogue talking about politics, like, very much, do you?
Yeah, there's definitely a shift in the Teen Vogue aspect in terms of there's just more conversation happening that are not happening at Vogue itself. And I think that goes back to who's in the room mm. when these contents are mm. being pitched, or who's deciding what gets to be published and who gets to decide whose voice is heard as well.
You said that so much better than I was trying to say.
Is it also about who's buying that magazine, who's buying that content? Because, you know, if people, I think maybe there's a generational change, I hope there is, but are the people who are buying that content, they're not going to tolerate poor content.
Yeah, and like the generation that are reading Teen Vogue have grown up with the internet, and so they've had access to a lot more information than like boomers have. and like, so like they're more like sponges for like good content, if that makes sense.
Mm. Mm.
The yeah. question around magazines is also closely connected to gatekeeping. And Abby, that's essentially what you were just saying. And it reminded me of actually a comment that Lizzo made recently about, I'm going to paraphrase it terribly because I hadn't prepared to bring it up, but it just really reminded me of it. She was saying that essentially her type of fabulousness it would have just been so much more impossible for her to have been so stratospherically successful 20 years ago because of the gatekeepers having all that power.
Mm. Mm.
Do you feel that you benefit from this great new world with different or lesser gatekeepers?
To an extent, I would say. And I think this is where social media comes into. This is where social media comes into it. I believe that it's, I'm sorry, I'm nervous, guys. It's sort of allowed, social media sort of allowed for this new world in which the ideal woman or who is at the top to be challenged, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And it's allowed for an opportunity for people like Lizzo and people like me and people who are not mostly in the mainstream to I guess not work with the gatekeepers, but also create our own path, sort of, kind of, and become our own gatekeepers, I guess, if that's what I'm trying to get towards, yeah. But, yeah, do you have anything?
So punk rock, becoming your own, like, gatekeepers.
It's... Yeah.
Sometimes I feel disillusioned, though, when I think about how we now have these tools to decide for ourselves what we think beautiful even means, and yet research shows that we have en masse unhealthier than ever attitudes towards our bodies because of it just used to be this thing 30 years ago that the pressure very clearly came from magazines and advertisers, but it's just so much more insidious now. Does that get any of you down as much as it is also cause for celebration?
I try and curate my, like, Instagram, who I follow, to reflect what I believe, which I think helps a lot. I know that's easier said than done. But, I have definitely in the past gotten weighed down by just, like, societal pressures to look a certain way on, like, Instagram and stuff like that. And I still get caught up in it sometimes, but I try very... just, like, on purpose to not look at things that are going to make me question my worth. But it's a very, very purposeful thing. It's not just, like, it's very, like, I'm going to do this because it's good for me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I started following people who only look like me because I've previously I've realised that although I'm following these beautiful women who are... women of color or black women, I've noticed that even they sort of subscribe to this westernized standard of beauty as well. And that's something that I'm not able to obtain. And so I've subconsciously found myself sort of like comparing myself to them. And I'm just like, wait, no, like this is it's not doing me any good. So I might as well start following people that who I can see and I can be like, yeah, I look like this, or yeah, this is another person that I can sort of relate to.
Nikki, I feel like you've taken that one step further by doing all the myth-busting stuff where you sort of proactively call out the crap.
Yeah, I do. I try not to be too aggressive about it because that's just not my style. I don't want to be too I think one of the problems with doing that though is that it's, you know, the internet's just such a vile place sometimes and I never want to encourage pile-ons, which I think some people don't do. They genuinely don't ask for people to do that, but it happens anyway. But yeah, I think calling out bad information and also putting out good information. So, you know, it's okay. It's one thing to sort of say that's not okay. I'm not happy with that. But I think you need to, you know, replace that void with something good. But, you know, your social media feed should be curated. And, you know, look, for me, it's easy for me to find a whole bunch of people who look like me. I have very consciously, again, followed people who don't look like me, who even share different views to me. And I think that's been good at opening my eyes to, you know, as someone who's got quite a lot of privilege to what life is like outside of my little bubble.
Frances, I'm interested in coming back to you now because certainly from my perspective as someone who's been following not just your Instagram account but your just... the work that you're putting out into the world and the presence that you have been making for so many years. It was shocking to me to hear the project that you were approached about in August. Would you mind sharing that story with us? And I suppose with the framework of how frustrating it may have been that all you ever do is put out what I, to an outsider, seems to me like a really clear message, and yet for some people still to be not picking that up.
So I was approached by... I was really excited by the email, like, heading, because it was like, illustrate this book cover. And I was like, oh, that's one of my goals, illustrate a book cover. Let's have a little look. Please send me more information. And it ended up being, I didn't do it, the cover of the, it wasn't like the memoir, but it was a semi, like, biographical book about the woman who founded Weight Watchers.
And it was written by, it was just written by like her biggest fan basically. And the book was called This Is Big. And they wanted to use one of my illustrations like on the cover of a luscious lady like lying on a table. And like I did my research. I wasn't just like flat out no. I was like, okay, I want to like see what this book is actually about. And so I asked and then I got sent like a snippet and it was just very like just like really putting her on a pedestal of how like she changed the world through like starting this company. And yeah, so I said no. And I did, I wrote a polite but strongly worded email explaining why this was very triggering for me to receive this, because like even Weight Watchers in particular, my mum was on Weight Watchers when I was a kid, and even though she didn't like purposefully pass that on to me, it just happens. Your parents pass on their self, like how they view themselves onto their kids. So yeah, I like explained like this whole like essay on why I was not going to take the job, and they were like, "Oh my god, I'm so sorry. We'll approach someone else." I was like, "Good."
Yeah. The correct response would be, "So sorry, we'll change the book."
Yeah. But, yeah. We won't publish this. Would be good, but. Yeah.
Nikki, do you remember a couple? This is just reminding me. I feel like not that long ago, internal documents got leaked. It was either Jenny Craig or Weight Watchers that revealed that their intention all along was to get people stuck in the yo-yo.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I do vaguely remember that. I mean, of course, it's a business, you know, and you know that's what they want. It's in their best interest that we keep failing. You know, to say that Weight Watchers or any of these things has changed the world is, you know, yeah, they did, but not necessarily for the better. They've taught a whole, they haven't even taught a whole generation. They've taught multiple generations, particularly of women, to not trust their bodies, not trust their own physical hunger cues, to not trust themselves around food, to desire to be thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner. So you know, it is what they need. And look, you know, I don't doubt that some people who are, you know, involved in Weight Watchers or you know, any kind of health, fitness, wellness, diet thing, I think there are some people who genuinely think that they're doing a good job and doing the right thing and that they're trying to make people's lives better and healthier and whatever. But, you know, you can't be blind to the downside. I don't think that's acceptable anymore.
There's also an app designed by Weight Watchers for kids.
Oh, the kids one is interesting.
Where it, like, teaches them to count calories.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not necessary. It's really not necessary. Yeah. It shouldn't be something they should be, you know, doing if they genuinely need a medical diet change. Not, I'm talking about diet as in your eating pattern, not the thing that you buy off Weight Watchers. You know, then that's not the way to do it. You don't do it on an app. You do it with genuine professional guidance and assistance and help and with consent. You know, and that one blew my mind.
There was that study you referenced in your book, Nikki. Sorry, were you gonna say something?
Oh no, I was just gonna say it just goes back into like how they've capitalized on this whole diet culture where like
totally.
It's always
about cash.
Yeah.
Big money.
Yeah.
Because I was just remembered that study that you referenced in your book, Nikki, where they did that extreme diet on kids.
Yeah, so...
But it made it past ethics somehow.
Yeah, so, I mean, like I said, there are times when for medical reasons, we may need to alter what we eat or how active we are, and that's okay, but there was a study that was looking at severely restricting, you know, kids' caloric intake to a point where they wouldn't even have enough calories, enough energy to grow. And, you know, look, I'm not an eating disorders expert, but the eating disorders experts in the community were horrified. And I take their expertise on that. And, you know, I think dieting is not benign, is what I'm trying to get people to realise. You know, obviously what we eat is important, but dieting is not benign. It creates just a world of grief for a lot of people. I'm sure probably most people in this room.
Mm. I want to move now to, I think we have an incredible opportunity with these panelists to explore any criticisms, but also potentially any gaps or silences in this essay that you would have loved to have heard more about. It is an essay, it's about 25,000 words. So I think it's a safe presumption that it misses more than it includes. I might start at the end with you, Frances.
Sure. Personally, I found the first half of the book really difficult to mm-hmm. read because the first half is more your experience, and then the second half kind of goes into more of a wider point of view. Mm-hmm. So once I hit that point, I was like, ah. But the first half, I was like, I don't get this. I've never been thin. I've never had this. I've never had the experience of being a thin person. And so, like, a lot of the things that you talked about, just like flew over my head. Just I couldn't relate to them. But in saying that, you discussed that in the second half of the book, so I like breathed a sigh of relief though. I was like, oh, what if I hate this book?
Awkward.
yeah, but the way you kind of brought it back in the second half was...
Was there anything you wished it would hit that it didn't? Or anything you'd like the opportunity to talk about now?
Let me have a little think.
Yeah, absolutely. Keep
I think as a black woman, I was reading this from my perspective, and it was very hard for me, as you said, it was very hard for me to get into it, mm-hmm. just because it's not my experience and it's not something that I'm familiar with. And I guess the concept of thinness doesn't really relate to, I guess, I don't want to generalize, but I say that black women haven't really internalized this idea that being thin is what's right. Mm. And so, you know, what I've been told as someone who's growing up as a black woman, that it's the curvy ladies, it's the ladies with the small waist, with the big bum and the, you know, the nice breasts, that is the ideal woman. And so that's what you need to subscribe to. Mm. And so when I was reading this and it, you speak about your experiences of, you know, wanting to be as thin as Kate Moss or the girls on the Insta. It's just, it wasn't relatable, and I think that that's something that I would have hoped was explored more. And I know that in the second part of the book, you bring in the concept of hair, black women's hair, and how... Yes, yep. And how that relates back to identity. So I would have loved to see that more exploration as to... And I know that there's... You know, it's from your perspective, so there's not much that can really be said, but I... the idea of what black women perceive to be or what is being told is completely different to white women, and I think that's something that is not normally that is being told, and I think that that's something that I would like to see been spoken more about, yeah.
Mm. Thank you.
Yeah.
Frances, did you want to come back to you yet or a little bit longer or not at all?
I think I'm good. Thank you.
No worries.
It's really interesting to hear those points, actually, because I think they're important and valid, and, you know, I think it's very clearly shows why you need diverse voices. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting that we've already touched on it. It brought up a lot of thoughts for me about complicity, which we've already touched on. And, you know, because when I read your first book, you know, you touch on these kind of issues, and it was hard to read that while your first book was, you know, doing so well, that you were still having the same issues. And, you know, it brought on that sort of like, oh gosh, you know, how right is it to put an idea out into the world that, you know, I have a problem with my body, which a lot of people do, at the same time still having a problem with your body. And it made me feel a bit of complicity and a bit of guilt as well. You know, we've talked about social media already, but, you know, if you want to talk about Instagram, you know, the only way to get followers and to get your message out there, sorry, is to get followers and to get engagement. And often to do that, you need to post pictures of yourself.
Mm. So faces do better in the algorithms.
Correct. That's right. The algorithms are designed for for Faces, for example. And, you know, I mean, that's a company being complicit. But it did really, you know, so it's interesting that we've already touched on it, but it did bring up feelings about, you know, how complicit are we? Can you have a foot in both camps? You know, maybe you should have a foot in both camps. I think it's very vulnerable and brave to say that was my experience. But I think, you know, we probably need to be thinking, not necessarily in what we put out into the world as in social media or in a book or however, but, you know, those arguments hold true for our inner circles as well. So that was the most difficult part for me to come to grips with.
Mm. Frances, I remembered one thing I did want to ask you about that the book completely misses is the body positivity movement, mm-hmm. which you've been such a huge part of. And I wanted to get your thoughts on how you've seen that community online grow and change, if at all.
Sure. So I just want to like acknowledge that the body positive and fat positive movements were started by women of colour.
Yeah.
But I've been on board for a while. But I think, like, in the past few years, body positivity has been co-opted a lot by, wellness influencers as well. So it kind of brings something that was started by marginalised folk and brings it back into a very privileged space, which sucks. And that's why, like... people who are in marginalised groups, like, they're the voices that we should be lifting up in, like, body positive, fat positive movements. We should be, like, reposting their work. And, yeah, I think that's all I need to say about that.
Abby, I wanted to ask you, in the context of jubilous shouts from many people about the Victoria's Secret show being cancelled... whether or not we have all hung our hopes purely on Rihanna, and that essentially, do you see people sort of saying, oh, well, Rihanna's doing that, both in terms of the lingerie, sure, but also with her beauty products, and therefore other companies don't need to do that?
Yeah, it's so funny when Rihanna came out with her her beauty product, there wasn't... and one product that was catered to someone who was of my shade. And so when Rihanna came out with her line, it was just all of a sudden these beauty organizations woke up and said, oh my God, like, black women exist? Like, black women exist? What? what is this? What's going on? But Rihanna's not enough. One person is not enough. Because it's Rihanna, and then this whole other group of white-centered organization. And so we shouldn't put all the responsibility on one black woman. It needs to be a call to action on those white organizations to say, you know what, we do recognize that there is a diversity problem. We do recognize that it's on us, because they're the main holders of that the market. power, yes, to say
market and power, same thing.
It really needs to be on them, because at the end of the day, Rihanna's just one person, and it's all about power at the end of the day. And so if you have powerful organizations saying, well, you know, yeah, Rihanna's giving you this, you know, one, two shade, like, that's enough, right? It's not. It really isn't. It needs to be more. And it needs to be led by these organizations to really do something about it.
Yeah. You only need one bra, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's just all this labor, you know? It's too much.
I want to leave a full 15 minutes for audience questions, because we've all agreed we think that there are going to be great audience questions. But I do want to finish sort of on a more positive note, hopefully, amongst us. Nikki, risky question to end on a positive note with, is medicine improving in its treatment of fat people?
I don't have a lot of good things to say about my profession at the moment. Because there's a lot of problems with medicine that negate all of the good work that is done. And there is good work done, and there are good people, but then they just go and drop the ball. When it comes to people in bigger bodies, different bodies, different abilities, no. No, it hasn't. And I have to be honest, you know, in the last few years I've started to pick up on it more, and it is very hard to call out because the thinking and the entitlement to pass judgment on people for whatever reason is still very much there. But we pass judgment on each other, like with with wild abandon to other people's, to our colleagues' detriment. So I think that medicine needs to understand that you can be kind and compassionate to someone while still care about their health. And in fact, being kind and compassionate is actually the way to help them be healthier.
Mm. Abby, any good news stories apart from Rihanna?
Oh, no, not that I could. We're in November, so that's a few more weeks until the end of the year. No, not that I could think of.
Do you see more and more opportunities each year?
No, because I feel like the fakeness of social media is winding down. And I feel like at the beginning, when social media was at its most brightest, it created this fantasy that there is now a more opportunity in which we recognize women of color, queer people, and I think that's, from my observation, that is, because I've been on social media for such a long time, I think that's, I think we're coming back to where we used to be, where we're celebrating more of the ecocentric, and this is ecocentric features on women of color. So although we're saying that we're improving, we're still celebrating the same features that we see on like white women as well. So and I think that's, I don't know, a couple more years, I guess, but I don't know. Right now, it's not looking so good, fortunately. Sorry, that was so bad.
This is grim. Frances, are there any? There can be a fine line when any ism, but in this instance, intersectional feminism, hits the mainstream. Sometimes there can be a good little bit of effect in that, in just in terms of how it reaches more people than it would if it stayed sort of in the shadows of being a subculture. Do you see any of those benefits, or do you think they have now been completely consumed by that sort of capitalist problematic financial drive infrastructure?
Well, like, capitalism consumes everything.
Yes.
But I guess if the message is being spread, that at least is a positive thing. So if, even if it's like shitty companies, excuse me, language, bad companies who are hopping on the bandwagon of like intersectionality to make money, it's still representation. It's like so complicated though. Just like for me as a little fat girl, I would have really benefited from seeing my body type in mainstream media, and like wherever that came from would have still benefited me, I think. Do you agree? Do you reckon? Yeah. Okay. Representation is really important, and but capitalism is like really sinister though. So I think as long as we're consuming media with our brains switched on, I think that's the way to go. We can still enjoy intersectionality while still being like, that was still that company, whatever.
Mm. And I think as well, the exciting thing about the way we all use the internet now, Ta-Nehisi Coates just wrote this incredible piece that I want to completely paraphrase poorly, about how call-out culture itself is not new. Mm. Marginalised people have always been getting cancelled. Mm. The difference now is that marginalised groups can do the cancelling, and that's what people are so freaking out about and why people are so hating on cancel culture. And I get excited when I think about that combined with our power as consumers to communicate via sort of cancelling or calling out to corporations what we want to see.
I think cancel culture is like... it's also so murky because, like, we should be definitely cancelling people in power.
Yes, punching up.
But cancel culture often will cancel people who are just, like, fumbling their way through life. Correct. Who, like, we all make mistakes. So there's got to be a balance within cancel culture as well. Like, as long as people are learning and growing and apologising for their mistakes, this isn't, like, a, like, pat on the back for... You know, like, I think, like, as long as we're growing, there's no need to, like, be cancelling, like, just, like, regular folk, if that makes sense.
Yeah. But we can and should cancel Victoria's Secret.
For sure. Yes. 100%. Yeah. That's run by rich white man. So,
yes.
Get him out.
Wonderful. Okay, I have a timer now and I know that there are 14 minutes left. And so we're going to audience questions. The lovely Wheeler Centre staff have microphones that they will be taking around. Please put your hand up. Wonderful. Thank you so much for kicking us off.
My question's for Bree. So I read The Beauty Myth a couple of years ago and I read your book recently, obviously, and I call myself a feminist and I recognise that the patriarchal structures that are enforcing these beauty ideals are bullshit. And yet I still find myself enslaved to them, doing my makeup, doing my hair, going to the gym, counting calories, blah, blah, blah. And I feel like that almost adds an extra layer of shame that I feel bad to call myself a feminist when I'm enslaved to these structures that I recognise are bullshit. So how do you, or what advice would you give to someone that's struggling with that cognitive dissonance of I'm a feminist and I recognise this is bullshit, and yet I'm still existing in this system and being complicit in it?
Something, thank you very much for that question. That's... honestly, one of the really big drives I had in not even just writing the book but in reading and researching it, I just wanted to almost give myself permission to take a year or so to actually delve deeper into that, because something I think is very telling is that my first book is about surviving child sex crime and actually felt almost more shame about the body image stuff than I did. About the abuse. And I think that not just diagnosed eating disorders, but disordered eating, which so many more people suffer from in silence, is all the more damaging for how easily it is dismissed. And how we treat, in particular, women and queer folks' bodies, we treat, like, society treats them like crap and then shames them when they treat them like crap. And that's what I wanted. That's what I also struggled with and wanted to explore in the essay. I guess I found reading and researching beauty to be incredibly beneficial for me because it gave me language. And I think one of the most powerful things that anyone who is surviving any kind of marginalisation or adversity or trauma of any kind is that the first step is giving yourself permission to take that seriously and making space for yourself to just read, even if you don't write about it. But don't let others belittle the thing that they are making you struggle through. Definitely.
This is a question for all four of you. If you could snap your fingers and remove beauty as something that we prize or strive for, it just doesn't exist as something that we expect of ourselves or other people, would you do it?
I don't think so. I think it's more about challenging the definition of beauty. I think that's... I think that's what we're trying to do here as well. Because, like, oh my God, it's so corny, but beauty is from within. And so if I think we should all be striving to be beautiful people in the way that we, like, treat ourselves and treat others. Oh my god. but like that is what the definition of beauty should be, not like an outer thing. But then in about like outer appearance, like we should be challenging that as well, because like all bodies are beautiful, and we should be learning from the pain that the beauty industry has like put us all through. I don't know where I'm going with this, but we should be learning from that and challenging that, because I feel like if we just erased it all those lessons, we also wouldn't have learnt, if that makes sense. But also that's a lot of pain that would have been erased, so it's a hard question, but I think no. Short answer.
I think beauty has... beauty, once you queer it up, has such incredible potential. From OG ball culture, they used to say all this beauty, and now we have a modern iteration of that in something like RuPaul's Drag Race, where there is so much incredible writing out there about parents watching RuPaul's Drag Race with their children, regardless of the gender of their children, because it's just this masterclass in acknowledging the performance of femininity. And what incredible a tool beauty might be to sort of overperform or even perform a bit, as long as we are thinking critically about that and doing it with generosity. And I think, if we were better to ourselves and to each other, and if it weren't for late capitalism, beauty could be a tool for more good than evil.
I want to just like tack on to what you were saying about femininity, because beauty is often like paired with femininity, and if we erased that, it would also be, I think, erasing femininity, which is a really important, just a really important thing in both men and women. Just like masculinity is important too, but femininity in particular is so trodden down. So by erasing the concept of beauty, I feel like we'd be erasing a little bit of that as well.
Mm.
I like that.
Abby or Nikki, did you want to add to that, or?
I can't add anything better than what's been said. So.
Yeah. Cool. Next question.
With what you were saying about Rihanna creating the brands and the inclusivity and everything of that, and then the other companies surrounding that, then jumping on board, my concern would be that it's taking away from what she's doing. The money is going elsewhere and it's co-opting the space that she's created. And how do we manage that, in a sense? I want to support
what Rihanna's doing and everything like that, but also having the rest of the company so that it's... I don't want to take away from her, but also everyone else needs to do it as well. How do we balance that?
It's tricky. I don't know, I guess... It's just capitalism at the end of the day, honestly. Like, if you get rid of that, I think all our problems would be okay. But I honestly don't know. Because, yeah, you're right, we don't want to take away from what she's doing. But then we also want... I honestly don't know. I don't know if...
Can I say something?
Yeah.
I was recently working with a brand... I was working with... Thinks, who do the period underwear, and they were talking about how they were the first ones to do it, but there have been other brands that have popped up, and having brands to, I'm like, the only word that's coming to mind is enemy brands, but having
competitors.
Brands that they competitors, thank you, having
battle lines,
having competitors helps, like within capitalism, but it helps them like do their thing. So like with Rihanna having competitors, she can still like one up them with what she does and do it better, and they have to one up, and then like, so it in this murky system that is capitalism, it's good to have competitors, but in saying that, it's still better to support like the women and people of color led businesses.
Also, just quickly from a very pragmatic perspective, marginalized women and women of color, culturally and linguistically diverse women, are more likely to fill lower paid service roles where they make less money but also have higher expectations for makeup and beautifying procedures. And Fenty and Rihanna's makeup products are simply inaccessible for a lot of those women, precisely because of the intersection where they sit. And so I also think there is room for women who can afford it to buy the products that are really the new shades and lines that are absolutely spearheaded by Rihanna, but it is absolutely critical and necessary that the surrounding Maybellines and NYCs or whatever they are at that the local chemist get on board so that actually those shades are properly accessible. Next question. Yep, there's one up the back there somewhere.
So what you were saying on body positivity and how it's being co-opted by certain sort of wellness movements and everything, Jamila Jamil recently came out with the term body neutrality, where we're not thinking about our bodies at all. Do you think that there's any scope to move into that sphere at all in social media or in life in the next few years?
So I talk a little bit, I went sort of delving into body positivity a little bit in my book for a couple of reasons. One, because one of the criticisms around body positivity is that it promotes obesity, which is just such a lie. It doesn't. No, I think no more than, you know, thank God, watching a Victoria's Secret show is going to make you automatically thin. It's just such a stupid premise. But the other thing around body positivity is that, yeah, for some people it creates another thing that they fail at, another thing that you can't do, that you can't love your body unconditionally and look at all the lumps and bumps and go, it's still beautiful, it's still my home and all that kind of thing. So body neutrality, I think, is a really interesting concept. And, you know, from a purely scientific point of view, if you want to have a healthy mind and body, stop looking at what it looks like, stop bothering about what it looks like and look about what it can do. And I think that body neutrality, I think, you know, if you put terms aside, just taking that away and cultivating a positive body image, which is not body positivity, thinking that your body is has value despite what it looks like. It has value even if it's, if you're not able-bodied, that it has value for what it can do, that you can take the slings and arrows, you can take the days when you feel a bit yuck, and you can also take the times when you feel amazing and incorporate that into a sense of self. So, yeah, I agree. I have some minor problems with body positivity over the movement, but the co-opting of it by wellness people and by, I saw a lingerie brand with a girl who was like, she was so ripped, saying that they're a body positivity lingerie brand. I just lost my tiny mind. It's just not appropriate. It's just crap. So I think that you're absolutely right. I think that it's time to, you know, shift away from a pure focus on aesthetics.
Can I add, just like whatever makes you feel good is what you should be doing.
Correct.
So if being body positive makes you feel whole in yourself and makes you feel good about your body and good about who you are, then go for it. But if it makes you feel shit, hop on the body neutrality.
Yeah, totally.
Bandwagon.
Totally. Yeah, yeah, agree. Yep.
We have time for one more question. Sorry.
No pressure.
Competitors.
Thank you to each of you. What I've noticed to be a common thread amongst all of you is that you all have your own unique experience with the notion of beauty. And so what makes challenging this notion of beauty so difficult is conveying that unique message in a uniform way. To each of you, do you have any reflections on how to do this in a positive way, collectively and individually, so that way the message is not lost?
Good question.
Sorry if that's too intense.
Maybe it doesn't have to be uniform.
Yeah,
maybe
that's what I was just thinking. Yeah, this is glorious that everyone has something different.
I can't, there's no way I can speak for anyone else on this panel or in the room or in the world. And maybe that's just the idea. You have more people putting in their two cents worth, and sometimes they're going to be different. You know, it's going to be a different experience, it's going to be a different opinion, it's going to be a different solution, and that's cool. Sorry, that was completely unhelpful.
Were you going to say something, Abby?
No, I was just agreeing.
I'll add something. I think just like a way to make it into a whole kind of thing is just like respecting yourself and respecting other people. So respecting your own experience and respecting the experiences of people around you and people who are different from you. And that's like a way for us to like, it's like a simple package, but it's like a, it's a hard thing to do. But I think that like, if we all showed each other with, showed each other more respect, it's like blinking red.
Yeah, no, it's really
each other, I think a lot more good would be done.
We have to finish now. I want to mention that the wonderful bookstore Hill of Content is selling Frances's books, the magazine on which Abby is cover girl, and Nikki's, I think, first and second books. Nikki has to run away to get a flight, but there are signed copies of her books available, and my books as well. And I just want to say once again, this has just been a writer's dream come true to chair this panel. Thank you so very, very much, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing, and ideas from Melbourne, Australia, and the world.